Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with science fiction writer Gregory Benford, whose most recent novel is Shipstar, and who will be the featured speaker at this weekend's Contraflow. And poet Ralph Adamo talks about his new book, Ever. Gregory Benford is one of the masters of science fiction with more than 20 novels and many short stories to his credit. He's won both the Nebula and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award, those prestigious science fiction awards, and he's been nominated multiple times for the Hugo and the Nebula. His most recent works were co-authored with Larry Niven, Bowl of Heaven and Shipstar. He's also a scientist, a plasma physicist who teaches at the University of California, Irvine. And luckily for New Orleans readers and guests, he'll be the featured speaker at Contraflow, the annual science fiction and fantasy convention that takes place this weekend. Gregory Benford, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Always glad to be back in New Orleans.
Now, I think some people might not know that you are a Southern boy, that you were born in Mobile. Did growing up in the South influence you as a storyteller in any way?
Quite a bit. I learned storytelling from my father and grandfather, who were great tale spinners, and I think got this kind of Faulknerian gene installed early, and indeed I'm a huge fan of William Faulkner. So I was always interested in that, and also in science. So writing science fiction about scientists seemed to me to be a natural path, and I began to write and sell short stories to magazines when I was in graduate school getting my doctorate at the University of California.
But you were pretty young when you published your first works.
I was 22, 23. Mm-hmm. It seemed a natural progression. I had already edited over, 29 issues of a fanzine and written a great deal for it. So I'd written my first million lousy words, which Ray Bradbury said that to me. He said, you've got to write a million bad words before you write good ones.
And now you're recognized as one of the great writers of hard science fiction. Could you tell, for the uninitiated, what is hard science fiction?
Hard SF is scrupulous about the facts and the methods of science and does not misrepresent the world by invoking magic or by implausible methods of finding out what's going on. It's almost like police procedural in that way. The two genres are sort of related in that they try to obey the rules, the laws. Mm-hmm. Detectives obey men's laws, and scientists and science fiction writers, I think, should obey the laws of nature.
Well, you do have that wonderful quote from Robert Heinlein in Bowl of Heaven. It's like, one man's magic is another man's engineering. So.
Yeah, I do
love that. Now, your most recent works have been collaborative novels with Larry Niven. Bowl of Heaven was published in 2012, followed by Shipstar earlier this year. And these are in the tradition of stories about big, dumb objects, as you and Larry say. But you also said that there are answers to this question, and it's that great what-if question that informs all fiction. You know, what would intelligent life do if it really had a lot of time and a big energy budget, and motivations that were not ours? I love that quotation. So what was it like to think of the other motivations?
We tried to see what grandiose thing a strange mind might do if it was interested in the galaxy. So the object, the Bowl of Heaven, in these two novels, is in fact an enormous construct the size of a solar system that is voyaging through the galaxy to explore it. Instead of sending out little ships with people or aliens in them, you take your whole society and your biosphere with you to go visiting. And obviously this is a long-term prospect, so you need to think long-term. And then how do you stabilize such a society over such times? You see, Humans don't think over long-term scales, but aliens who've been around a long time will have had to. That was the opening question, and then we looked at each other and said, who are these aliens anyway?
So how did you and Larry go about creating that mindset? I mean, is it a matter of a long conversation, playing games with each other, posing questions? What is it that goes into the evolution of something like that?
All of those things.
Or drinking, lots of drinking maybe?
Yes, lots of drinking. and we would kick the ideas back and forth. I remember realizing that, you know, when you blunder into a new large city, the first person you meet is not going to be the mayor, right? It's going to be a cop or something like that. So that's what happens to our protagonist. We have many different kinds of aliens, some of which have been imported into the Bowl of Heaven in the millions of years of its own past. So they're not all native to the Bowl. Somebody built the Bowl, and a great deal of the two-book series is about trying to find out who that is.
Well, one of the fascinating things about it is that in these two books, the species you encounter in the landscape are almost as interesting as the landscape itself. So how does that process work? What comes first for you, that landscape or the alien intelligences? I mean, characters or landscape? How does that work?
There's a lot of physics in the landscape because, after all, it's an enormous building, essentially. And I did all that physics, and the book even has diagrams and pictures to make things clear. Larry was in charge of mostly inventing the aliens because that's his strong suit. And we invented more aliens as we went through until you finally realize toward the end that the Bowl is run by aliens that are you can't even see or very hard to find. So finally, at the end of the second book, Shipstar, we come to realize that the ones who built it and ran the Bowl of Heaven are not obvious and may be in places that you wouldn't at first think of even looking because they are completely outside the range of human thinking.
Now, you're very committed to being able to visualize what you write about to the point that you've actually commissioned art to represent these visions.
Yes, I asked my old buddy Don Davis, a professional astronomical artist, to do the paintings. And we had a lot of fun going back and forth to see our own ideas made real. And Don produced great paintings for us, which are in the books. And this is not a method that writers typically use, but we had a large budget because Hilary and I have sold a lot of prior books. So we just decided to indulge ourselves. This would help us, so we did it.
Oh, I think it makes everything a lot more fun. That's kind of like a writer's dream, you know, to see it visually unfold. That's kind of wonderful.
Writers think that it would be great to have your book made into a movie, but I'd rather do the picturing myself and hire an artist to do it.
Now, time has always been one of your major concerns in your fiction. And one of the really interesting things about Bowl of Heaven is that you've got these scientists and you put them into a cold sleep and they're hurtling across the galaxy and they're going to wake up and the whole landscape will have changed, which is a fairly common theme in science fiction, I think. But time itself has always been your great preoccupation, hasn't it?
Yes, it started out in my physics career when I published a paper over 40 years ago about tachyons, so-called faster than light particles, that make it possible to send messages backward in time. That's the origin of my best-known novel, Timescape, which looks exactly at what happens when you get a signal in the future and how do you make people believe it's true. But the other side of the novel looks at those who are sending the signal and asks why. And that intrigued me a great deal. And it's also a novel about how scientists think because all the major characters are scientists.
Now, you have said that writing science fiction is like doing science when it's really good. And there aren't many science fiction writers who can say that they've published more than 150 scientific papers. So would you talk a bit about what you mean by doing science? And then science fiction?
There's a spirit of innovation and yet being constrained by the real world that I like in science, always have, and also like in science fiction. That's why I don't write fantasy. And in graduate school, I remember when I was writing my first short stories and selling them to magazines, thinking that there should be a way to satisfy both your sense of wonder and your sense of exactitude. And that's kind of the punch I got out of such writing, and still do.
And so much of what you call doing science is collaborative as well, huh?
It's striking that science fiction is the only genre in which collaboration is common. Lots and lots of books with two or even three authors. And that is not true in any other genre I know. But I think that's because science fiction comes directly out of the scientific and technical culture. That's its origin. The first American science fiction magazine, Amazing Stories, was started as a sidelight from a line of radio magazines in the 1920s. And so you can look at it in a lofty way, a cultural expression of the scientific technical elite that has slowly emerged over the last two centuries and in science fiction found its own voice.
So what's the stronger part of you, the scientist or the fiction writer?
Yes. They go back and forth. It's not schizophrenic.
Oh, I think it's kind of great.
Well, look at it this way. When you start to develop a new scientific theory, of however great depth it might have, you have to use your imagination to remain within the constraints of what we know and yet venture beyond it into something new. You cannot have a future. Our whole culture cannot have a future that it does not first imagine.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things you said, and I'm so sorry I did not know this, was that science fiction actually gave us the word fandom.
Well, yes, fandom, the word fanzine, a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. Were invented as terms by science fiction fans because, also uniquely, science fiction always had a close connection to its readership. The early SF magazines all had letter columns. Some of them still do. That was not true of mysteries or westerns or romance or war stories or anything else, in part because everybody wanted to talk about the ideas. Westerns, in a sense, are not about the ideas. It's about the drama. But science fiction is about the concepts you can kick back and forth, and that's part of why, of all genres, it has grown enormously in the last century, whereas other genres, like the Western, at least in written form, have dwindled almost completely away.
So talk a little bit for me about how you feel about gatherings like Contraflow and what their role is in the culture.
Contraflow is a very interesting con because it continues that letter column society that science fiction always has and still has. So now there are science fiction conventions that are easily over 10,000 people. Contraflow is a small one, though, which I like because you get to really talk to a limited number of fans instead of, as I did in London a couple of months ago, sign 1,000 books and barely get time to actually talk to anyone who's actually read the books because there's so many who want you to scribble your name. And I have a long name, which takes time.
And Contraflow is only 4 years old, so they're young, but they've come pretty far in a short time.
Yes. Contraflow has risen quickly. They're even talking about putting on the World Science Fiction Convention sometime in the next decade, which would be great. It would be the second World SFCon. No, the third in New Orleans itself.
Excellent. Like that would be so much fun.
New Orleans is one of my very favorite cities, maybe the favorite. Of course, I grew up near it, so and it's in the South. What's not to like?
Exactly. Well, come on back. It's going to be great. We've been talking with Gregory Benford, whose most recent novel, co-authored with Larry Niven, is Shipstar. You can meet him this weekend at Contraflow, the annual science fiction and fantasy convention, which runs Friday, October 3rd through Sunday, October 5th, with most events taking place at the Airport Hilton in Kenner. Gregory Benford is the guest of honor. For more information and to register, go to contraflowscifi.org. Thank you so much, Gregory.
Thank you. It's fun. All that is now.
Ralph Adamo has been part of the New Orleans poetry scene for as long as I can remember. He's a New Orleans native who's taught at the University of New Orleans, Loyola, and now he teaches at Xavier, where he edits the Xavier Review. Today we'll be talking about his seventh collection of poems called Ever, Poems 2000 to 2014. Hi, Ralph.
Hey, how are you?
Welcome. Now, the poems in Ever were written over 14 years, yeah. And a lot has happened to you yeah. in those 14 years. And so many of the poems in this collection are about time. Those are the names of the four sections, central time, sampling time, in time out, and after. So how did you decide the time was right to stop, you know, to put the collection together?
I've been trying to sort of stop for a while and put it together, and I've sent out versions of it in the last couple of years. And finally decided, you know, right here, Lavender Inc. was probably the best publisher I could find because I could work with him. He's a great editor, a great publisher, Bill Lavender, and it just seemed like the right time.
And a poet himself.
And a terrific poet, right. And I have, since we started working on publishing the book, I have kind of deliberately refused to write poems. You know, when it kind of starts, I stop it. And
really?
How yeah. interesting. Well, I mean, you know, it's not that hard. And and what I've been trying to do instead is write essays and or begin essays anyway to change. You know, it's kind of like when I, as I will, I'm sure, return to writing poetry, I would like to be writing different poems from the ones that I've just published.
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
How interesting. Now, some of my favorite poems in this book, of course, are about being a father. Hmm. They're really right to the heart of what it means to be a parent. And I wonder if you'd read that first poem in the collection, Ballets of Avoidance at Supper Time, for us.
I would love to. Thank you. Ballets of Avoidance at Supper Time. Lily likes me to whisper in her ear. I whisper, my children are exhausting. It helps her go to sleep the way a walking lullaby used to. I whisper, I have no memory left. The important moments have vanished, the trivial too. I belong only to them now. It calms the rush of time down a click to recall this. I whisper, riddle means dark language. And so it stands to reason, lovely phrase. My life has been a riddle. Moon's the answer, says Lily. Jack thinks mushroom. I hear me whisper, as old as the earth is, that's how much I love you. As aromatic as the late summer rain. As complete as your grandfather's sleep. Lily is reading Cat in the Hat to her little bronze snails and frogs while Jack makes stars for a universe he is creating, claiming as he does the stars have begun spontaneous propagation and the cat is making the stars dizzy, says Jack to Lily, while our organic black cat bear chases litters of Jack's stars across the floor.
I don't know any parent who would read that and not say, oh, yes, I know.
Oh, I hope so.
Oh, now you've lived this kind of what I think of as the complete poet's life. You know, you're a practicing poet. You've been a teacher for so long and an editor of others' works, most notably Everett Maddox and that last collection, I Hope It's Not Over
and Goodbye.
And Goodbye.
Which is
I love that.
One of his poems.
Yeah, I know. I love that funny. Title. And you've edited Barataria, the mm-hmm. New Orleans Review, the Xavier Review. Mm-hmm. You've had a hand in everything all along the way. So how important is the teaching and editing part for you?
Well, there's no order to this, but it's a living for one thing.
Right.
that's pretty important. Mm-hmm. Teaching has been, you know, I avoided it for a long time after graduate school. I did everything else I could do. I was a stagehand. I did some carpentry. I was a journalist,
right.
sort of. But when I finally went back to it, I just loved it. And the little bit of time, for instance, after Katrina, when I was disemployed for a while, I really missed having students and being in a classroom, you know, not just to hear myself talk, but because there's something so invigorating about the students, mm-hmm. about themselves, you know, their youth, their energy, their interest, you know. So it's very important to me. The editing, I also love. I mean, when I find something, particularly from somebody I've never heard of, which is mostly what I get, and somebody, you know, younger or just starting, that's so good. You know, it's my privilege to be able to show it to people. So
you said something that I thought was really, really lovely. You said that I've worked hard to teach in a way that leaves residual skills and hungers in my students' lives. So talk about the skill and the hunger. How do you match those things up in your own life and in your students' lives?
I guess part of that idea was just that, you know, I understand that during the 15 or 13 weeks of teaching, you know, as much happens as can happen, but what happens isn't the end of the story. It, you know, if you're doing a good job as a teacher, what you've done continues to echo, influence, interfere with, annoy, whatever, the students as they go on, you know, and mm-hmm. hopefully the way I do too, when I start thinking about things that I didn't understand and now I understand them, I hope that that happens with them, you know. As for hungers, I think everybody should read and everybody should write, and I just want those activities, those skills to be ones that people gravitate back toward. I know it's kind of an uphill fight right now because of where we are in terms of reading and writing. But on the other hand, even the electronic, you know, revolution that we're in kind of requires people to read and write maybe more than people used to. So I'm kind of mm-hmm. encouraged a little bit by that.
Now, you invoke some really well-known New Orleans figures in these poems. Mm. Maxine, Bob, and Rhett. I remember.
Several Bobs.
And I wonder if you'd explain who they are for folks who don't know.
Well, Maxine Cassin was just a terrific poet and also the publisher of New Orleans Poetry Journal Press, which published books of poems from the 50s through the 90s. She and her husband both passed away a few years ago, never really quite recovered from Katrina.
Yeah.
There's several Bobs. There's Bob Wolf, who was a wonderful human being and a friend of Everett Maddox's from Alabama. There's Bob Stock, who is a poet in my book, was a poet who died in New Orleans in the 80s. Bob Sabatier, who died recently, who was a wonderful but very little known poet. There's another Bob in there I'm forgetting. But anyway.
Brissotti, maybe.
Bob Brissotti, right. Another poet who
and
died.
And then Rhett, of course, is Everett Maddox.
Everett Maddox, right, whom all call Rhett. Yeah, so you've sort of touched on something I didn't realize till after I had put the manuscript together, and that is there are a lot of elegies.
It's really a very
elegiac kind of book. Hadn't intended that. It's just, as you say, you know, what was happening, I guess.
Don Best. So read two for Bob for us and tell us about this poem.
It's actually called Two from Memory. Both of these are, I have to say, poems inspired by Bill Lavender wrote a book called Memory Wing, which I think is just one of the great book of poems. And one of the reasons I think it's a great book of poems is everyone that has encountered it wants to write one mm-hmm. of those poems themselves. And this is sort of my version of that, Two from Memory. It's called Drink and Go with Bob Stock. He had been a fairly successful, well-known poet in San Francisco during the beat era, but he wasn't a beat poet. He was a formalist poet, and he also spent a lot of time in Latin America. He came here to New Orleans sometime, I think, in the 70s, maybe the early 80s, with a fairly large family, but they were all grown. And he kind of, I think, separated himself a little bit from his family and to try to return to writing. I'm not sure what. So that's sort of what this poem is about. Mm-hmm. It was pretty brave of him walking out every day with so few teeth in his head, and he had been a handsome man with a thick head of hair, now still thick but gray and unwashed. And of course, as a poet, he had to keep opening his mouth even when he wasn't writing a poem or reading one. As Whitehead said, the thing I tried to block believing, we live in our talk. He was still talking all the time with whomever was sitting across or next to him, frequently when I knew him, Rhett, or he'd be teaching the bartender how to play Go, or flirting, sort of. And then there was Peggy, about his age, a soft woman, still pretty but badly used, porous, quiet. Somehow in love with Bob, we could all see, and he with her. And while her smile had all the pain and hope in the Western world in it, his was just glad to be alive, joyous that way when it came. And when he died, Peggy's daughter, they were all living together, let Rhett, probably the last time any woman did. And this was 83, 84. And I can't say where they buried Bob, his family, a wife, and many kids who claimed him back for eternity.
Mm. Well, not all these poems are elegies. No. Let's make that clear.
No,
we've been talking with poet Ralph Adamo, whose new book is Ever, Poems 2000 to 2014. You can meet him October 8th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, discussing Everett Maddox's legacy with Julie Kane and Tom Bonner. Ralph, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been really fun. Appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poets and teachers Brad Richard and Carolyn Hembry read and sign copies of their books at 7, Tuesday, September 30th, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Andy Eaton signs New Orleans Style, Wednesday, October 1st from 5 to 8, at Hotel Modern's Belloc on Lee Circle. Laura Lane McNeil discusses her novel, Doll Baby, Wednesday, October 1st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This kicks off the annual Coffee and Conversation series, sponsored by the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the Jefferson Parish Library. James Nolan reads from and signs You Don't Know Me, New and Selected Stories, Thursday, October 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ken Wheaton signs Sweet as Cane, Salty as Tears, Thursday, October 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Contraflow, the annual science fiction and fantasy convention, runs Friday, October 3rd through Sunday, October 5th, with most events taking place at the Airport Hilton in Kenner. There will be 35 guests on hand, including today's guest, award-winning science fiction writer Gregory Benford, as well as a full program of events, panels, and parties. For more information, go to contraflowsci-fi.org. Kit Wall signs New Orleans Classic Creole Recipes, Saturday, October 4th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Ralph Adamo, appears with Julie Kane and Tom Bonner to discuss the work of the late Everett Maddox, Wednesday, October 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And don't forget this fall's book sales. Ongoing book sales at Ladder Library, sponsored by the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library, continue every Wednesday and Saturday from 10 to 2 in the Carriage House behind Ladder. And the Jefferson Parish Library Big Book Sale, sponsored by Friends of the Jefferson Public Library, takes place October 16th through 19th at the Pontchartrain Center. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans celebrate National Reading Group Month in October, with readings around the Big Easy Saturday, October 18th, an all-day event featuring local writers and celebrating local book clubs and reading groups. It's free with NOMA admission, except for Tea with the Authors, which requires registration. Check out NOMA.org for more information. The Tulane English Department and Newcomb College Institute sponsor Thinking on the Page, Women in Biography and Memoir. That's a day-long symposium featuring Patricia Bosworth, Vivian Gornick, Wendy Lesser, and Brenda Wineapple, Saturday, October 25th at Freeman Auditorium, Woldenburg Arts Center at Tulane. The Louisiana Book Festival will hold a series of word shops, October 31st, the day before the festival itself. Offerings include Finding the Story, led by Jill McCorkle, Breaking the Rules, a teen writing workshop for the creatively hyperactive, led by Mark Dunn. You Can Do a Graphic Novel, led by Barbara Slate. Making Poems Out of Your Own Experience, led by State Poet Laureate Ava Lavelle Heyman. The Lovely Bones, Organizing Your Research and Your Writing, led by Earl Swift. For more information and to register, check out louisianabookfestival.org. And we'd like to give a shout-out to some of the local nominees for the National Book Awards. Part-time New Orleanian Nigel Hamilton was nominated for the Mantle of Command, FDR War 1941-42. And Walter Isaacson was nominated for The Innovators, How a Group of Inventors, Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. And also of interest to local readers is John Lahr's biography, Tennessee Williams, Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.